Gothvik, it felt odd at first to be sitting across the table from his old pal. But the two men understood what was really going on, and their close relationship and common goals made deal-making a snap. With little debate, they got to a $60 million price for the rights to the Gold Cup and CONCACAF Champions League games through 2022. As for President Jeffrey Webb's private cut, $2 million seemed like a pretty good number. Life was good. In early November, Sands had rewarded himself for all his luck with a $1.4 million dream home in a desirable corner of Miami's Coconut Grove. Tucked behind protective walls, thick foliage, and tall palms, the property featured a lush tropical garden, swimming pool, and a guest house. On the wall, he hung a painting that Kostas Takis had bought from a New York gallery at Sands's request, paying with a check drawn from funds from the first round of bribes paid to Webb. From the same pool of money, Takis also paid for a remodel of Sands's new kitchen. Then, one day in early January 2014, FBI Special Agent John Penza walked up the short path to Sands's entrance gate and rang the doorbell. As the primary case agent, Jared Randall would have ordinarily made the trip to Miami, but he was out of the country on a temporary duty assignment at the U.S. Embassy in Colombia. Mike Gaeta was out of the picture, too, having just moved to one of those coveted foreign spots in Rome. So the task fell to Penza. The flashily dressed supervisor was still new to the case, which, with its massive quantity of bank records in multiple languages, had become mind-bendingly complex. If the prosecutors wanted someone to approach a man in Miami named Enrique Sands, then that was what Penza would do, but he wasn't going to try to flip him on the spot. He didn't bother to do any surveillance or anything fancy. Penza simply flew down that same day, drove to the house, and when Sands's wife came to the door, asked her to call her husband, who was at work, and tell him to come home. She did. When Sands arrived, Penza asked to speak privately. He gave him his card. Said there was a grand jury investigation of corruption in soccer underway in Brooklyn, that he was being looked at by the prosecutors, and he should probably get a lawyer. Before leaving, Penza told Sands one more thing. He wasn't to tell anyone. In August 2013, Brazil passed its first law conferring benefits on defendants who help an ongoing criminal investigation. In exchange for identifying criminals involved in organized crime, preventing further illegal acts, or locating victims, cooperators could get their sentences reduced by as much as two-thirds, or in some cases even have their convictions completely wiped. The controversial law has since been used to power several massive investigations of the country's rampant corruption, and led to criminal charges being filed against two former presidents. Previously, though, Brazil had no formalized system for cooperation, and defendants saw little upside to aiding law enforcement. On the contrary, the country's judicial system was viewed as itself hopelessly corrupt, with punishment dispensed only to the poor and unfortunate. Wealthy Brazilians like José Ávila, meanwhile, were accustomed to erasing their legal woes with the help of pricey lawyers, and viewed justice as just one more thing that could be bought and sold. As serious as his legal predicament was, Ávila had never seemed to fully grasp the concept of cooperation, or, for that matter, that he had actually done anything wrong. The bribes he'd paid over the years were certainly an unpleasant part of the business, but as far as he was concerned, they were just what Brazilians referred to as propinas, literally tips, and part of the day-to-day cost of doing business. Norris and other prosecutors had tried to open his eyes to a situation. They were sure that forcing him to put up all his assets, to live in New York during its long, cold winter, wear an ankle bracelet, and constantly check in with the FBI, would convince him of the gravity of his situation. But no sooner had the handcuffs come off than Ávila refocused on protecting traffic, so it could be sold for the highest possible price. It was critical, as far as he was concerned, that the prosecutors never learned that his company had not only continued to pay bribes, but was at that very moment smack in the middle of a gargantuan corruption scheme entailing tens of millions of dollars in bribes to officials at two confederations simultaneously. If that piece of information got out, the prosecutors might find a way to pull the plug on the Copa America deal, and Avila would lose a lot of money. More than once, Avila had considered abandoning the proffers altogether, halting his cooperation and fighting the charges against him, just so he wouldn't have to keep talking to the prosecutors. But that was a highly risky move, and probably would land him in prison. So instead, Avila worked hard to tell the investigators what he thought they wanted to hear, while assiduously keeping the rest of the story quiet. Accordingly, Avila played the role of the repentant sinner, telling Norris and the others that he was ashamed of his past corruptions, apologizing for what he called mistakes in his past, and insisting he had moved on from that kind of thing. Avila backed up his stories with reams of old contracts, bank payment instructions, and correspondence. He helped connect the dots in some of the incredibly complicated payments that Berryman had tracked down with his exhaustive searches. He was meeting suspects while wearing a wire and popping into Traffic's Miami offices once a week for appearances' sake, taking advantage of the visits to pick up documents Norris had asked him to retrieve. The old Brazilian could be a handful, no doubt, but everyone on the case agreed that he was a far better cooperator than they could have hoped for. And then, unbeknownst to Avila, Enrique Sanz began cooperating as well. After his visit from the FBI, the CONCACAF General Secretary had hired a lawyer and, after considering his options, decided to help the investigation. He flew to New York to attend the Super Bowl on February 2nd, and the next day went to Brooklyn to make his first proffer. The investigators had targeted him largely because of the years he'd spent at Traffic and its predecessor company in Miami negotiating bribe payments to Jack Warner. And at first, that was a primary focus of their conversations with the young soccer official. But as Sanz continued to talk, a distinctly different and very much ongoing tale of corruption began to emerge. Unlike his former boss, he told them everything. As it happened, Norris and the other prosecutors had been meeting separately with Avila at the same time, quizzing him in one session about decades-old sponsorship deals Avila had brokered between Coca-Cola and Brazil's Soccer Confederation, among other relatively dusty topics. It seemed like just another proffer session, and Avila behaved as he always did. So when, just a day or two later, Sanz made it clear to the prosecutors that the traffic boss had been lying to their faces for months, they were beyond furious. A cooperator who lied was useless to the prosecution. Less than useless. If Avila were caught in a lie by a defense attorney on the witness stand, it could make it impossible to secure a conviction and taint the whole case. The entire investigation was at risk. Norris summoned Avila to Brooklyn the following Monday, March 3rd, and made himself as clear as he could. Avila could be arrested a second time, right that instant. They could slap him with new obstruction charges and put him behind bars. He had no idea how miserable they could make him. "We are here because I believe you have some things to tell us," Norris said, masking his seething fury in a cold and quiet monotone. Without mentioning Sanz or even hinting at what he knew or where he got the information, Norris told Avila he needed to understand they were watching him, spying on him, listening to his calls. There was nothing they didn't already know, and everything he said now, and from that point on, would be a test of his honesty. This was his last chance, and his retinue of $1,000-an-hour lawyers, embarrassed as they were at their client's behavior, couldn't protect him. The message finally sank in. Avila confessed to the prosecutors that even though he knew he wasn't supposed to, he had privately told Davidson and Sanz about the criminal investigation. He had also warned Sanz that he specifically could be targeted for recordings. Avila had done that, he said, in hopes that they would be careful and avoid saying anything that could further implicate Traffic or reveal his big secret. That, he made clear, was why Sanz had been evasive when Avila recorded him. But that was not all. Far from it. There had been multiple meetings, he said, with executives of Full Play and Torneos to resolve the Copa America lawsuit and join forces. There was the secret agreement with Media World to split the Caribbean World Cup qualifiers. And there were many, many bribes. To the South Americans, sure, but particularly to Jeffrey Webb. There was the $3 million promised to him for the CFU World Cup qualifiers deal, and another $1 million for the 2013 Gold Cup, plus an agreement to pay $2 million more for the next several Gold Cups, and probably others as well. It was hard to keep track of so many payments. Just a few weeks earlier, Avila added, he had discussed all of this over lunch in Miami with Davidson. The younger man had filled him in on the latest with the Copa America Centenario. The contracts were just about ready for signing, Davidson said, and Webb's take was going to be huge, $10 million, if they could just come up with a discreet way to channel that much money to him. It was stunning. Sands had given the prosecutors a strong suggestion something was amiss, but what Avila was telling them was far worse than they had ever imagined, and highly embarrassing. Traffic had continued spraying bribes everywhere. The man brought in to clean up CONCACAF, Jeffrey Webb, was even dirtier than his predecessors. They had no idea a Copa America to be hosted in the U.S. in 2016 was even in the works, and it was all happening right under their noses. When Avila finally finished, Norris told him to go home and decide if he was 100% committed to cooperating. If he wanted to stay out of jail, he better be. Late in the morning of March 16th, Aaron Davidson got off a flight at LaGuardia and took a shuttle to a nearby airport hotel, where Avila was waiting for him in the bar. Davidson had been in Los Angeles the previous week to attend a match in CONCACAF's annual club tournament, and soon after returning to Miami, his boss had called to ask if they could meet. It was fairly urgent, Avila said, and the conversation had to be in person. Could he fly up to New York the next day? The lawyer knew his boss had been arrested, but he wasn't worried he would personally be implicated. Avila had repeatedly assured Davidson it was strictly a tax case, and nobody from the government had even considered looking at him. For nearly a year, that last part had been true. As president of Traffic USA, Davidson ran the Miami office, looked after the NASL, the failing little pro soccer league Traffic owned, and sold a few sponsorships. He had stayed clear of soccer's seamy side, and for a long time, Norris and the other prosecutors had told Avila not to even bother recording him. But now it had become clear that once Sands left Traffic, Davidson had stepped directly into the same filth. A bar and grill at the courtyard by Marriott Hotel deep in Queens struck Davidson as an odd meeting place, particularly given Avila's predilection for gourmet meals and five-star hotels. But he was a loyal employee. If Avila asked him to do something, he did it. The two men ordered lunch, and after a few minutes of conversation in Portuguese and Spanish, Avila lifted his pants leg, revealing the GPS monitor he wore on his ankle. "Can you see this?" he asked Davidson. "I'm wearing this bracelet here in order not to go to jail." The feds, he said, were all over him, and were planning to meet him the next day. "In order to protect the company, to protect myself, to protect you and Enrique," Avila said he needed to supply the agents with information about the various bribes Traffic had been involved with, particularly to Jeffrey Webb. "You do not think that he is," Davidson replied in a hushed voice. "No, no, no," Avila said. "There is no such risk." The young lawyer looked up to the scrawny old Brazilian, regarding him as a pioneer who tapped soccer's financial potential, lifted the parochial sport out of obscurity, and had given him a great career. He trusted his boss implicitly. "Webb wasn't being investigated," Avila assured him. But it was critical for Davidson to update him on the status of their rights deals, including the bribes, so he could fill in the feds the very next day. If he was caught lying to the government, he said, he'd be in serious trouble. So for the next hour and a half, Davidson answered all his mentor's questions. He described how Webb had originally wanted a $15 million payment for the Copa America Centenario, and how Sands and Burcaso had walked it down to $10 million, plus the $2 million for a long-term Gold Cup contract. He told Avila that Mariano Hincas of Full Play had called him the previous week, asking for suggestions on how best to pay Webb that $10 million bribe, but that Davidson had told him they could discuss it face-to-face. Media World, Traffic's partner for CONCACAF's World Cup qualifiers, was also having problems paying Webb, Davidson added. It still owed the Confederation president $1.5 million. It's half of the $3 million payment Sands had negotiated 2 years earlier. As the conversation progressed, Avila kept circling back, asking Davidson to repeat information about payments, to confirm and clarify what he had already said. And he also wanted Davidson, as a lawyer and an American, to address something for him. Was making all these payments, strictly speaking, illegal? Is it illegal? Davidson replied somewhat incredulously. It is illegal. Within the big picture of things, a company that has worked in this industry for 30 years, is it bad? It is bad. After the meeting was over, Davidson returned to the airport and flew back to Miami, contemplating all that had to be done in the coming weeks. Avila, meanwhile, left the hotel and met Jared Randall, who had been waiting nearby. He grimly handed the agent the hidden recording devices he had been carrying during lunch. Avila was now 100% committed. One day in the middle of March, Joe DiMaria, a fast-talking high-energy defense attorney in Miami, called up Amanda Hector with some bad news. His client, Enrique Sands, had leukemia. He was just 39, so the prognosis wasn't terrible, but it was a very serious disease and needed to be treated immediately. Sands couldn't keep proffering or doing undercover work, at least not for the time being, and by month's end would be announcing a leave of absence from CONCACAF. DiMaria had quickly developed a good rapport with Hector, who had taken the lead on handling Sands's cooperation. He had chatted with her about the case, and told her he thought the RICO theory in the case was too aggressive, more far-reaching than anything he'd ever seen. DiMaria was skeptical that so many crimes in so many places could be tied together with one central argument, and told her as much. Hector listened without comment. She knew, after all, much more than he did. "Thank you," Hector said to DiMaria, when he told her about Sands's cancer. "Keep us posted." The diagnosis presented a dilemma. In a very short time, Sands had become a vital piece of the investigation. He had been in the room for nearly every deal Traffic had signed in Central America and the Caribbean since the late 1990s, which meant he could personally walk the investigators through vast new avenues of corruption they had never even considered. He could also continue to serve as a kind of backstop to Avila, helping fact-check the information the reluctant Brazilian provided. Perhaps most promisingly, as the general secretary of CONCACAF, Sands was well-situated to help keep the case moving forward. It was as if Chuck Blazer had been wearing a wire for them back in 2010, when everything was happening, rather than after he'd been discredited and largely pushed out of the sport. Already, Sands had shown flashes of greatness as a cooperator. He understood what he had to do, and unlike Avila, kept his cooperation absolutely secret. He hadn't even told his wife. And just a few weeks in, his undercover work was already paying off. On February 25th, 2014, for example, Sands had worn a wire to a meeting in Miami with Julio Rocha, the former president of Nicaragua's Soccer Association. 3 years earlier, Sands told the prosecutors, he had negotiated a contract for Traffic to buy Nicaragua's 2018 World Cup qualifier rights, and to close the deal had sent a $150,000 bribe that Rocha said he would split with a colleague. Rocha was no longer running soccer in Nicaragua, but he wondered if Sands could put in a good word with him at Traffic, which would soon be negotiating for the rights to the 2022 World Cup qualifiers. Did Sands think, Rocha wondered aloud on tape, he could get a taste on that deal too? It was clearly only the beginning. But now that Sands was sick, the question was what to do with him. He had been involved in extensive illegal acts over a period of years and was, by any definition, a criminal. Cutting him completely loose was out of the question. But at the same time, it seemed a bit sadistic, and maybe even unethical, to continue to prosecute Sands, obliging him to keep cooperating. During chemo, his hair would fall out. He'd suffer terrible nausea and diarrhea, and he'd be incredibly weak and susceptible to infection, which meant he had to avoid contact with other people. Hector was a serious prosecutor. She and her twin sister had both graduated from Yale Law, and had gone on to be assistant U.S. attorneys, one in Brooklyn and the other across the river in Manhattan. She was competitive and known for a hard-charging demeanor that sometimes came across as harsh. But Hector advocated for mercy. Sands, she said, was the father of a young child, and he could die. Surely that was more important than any bribery case. Berryman took a more strident position. He had reviewed the bank records and traced all the bribes. He wanted to be sure that Sands didn't get away with his crimes. But it ultimately was Norris's call, and he came down on Hector's side. For now, Norris said, they were going to give Sands a break. Hector called DeMaria back to tell him that although they reserved the right to charge him down the road, for the time being he should focus on getting his treatment. Still, she added, Sands wasn't off the hook. When they called, he'd better answer. Chapter 24. All of Us Go to Prison. On the morning of May 1st, 2014, most of the Western Hemisphere's top soccer bosses descended on the luxurious St. Regis Bal Harbour Resort just north of Miami to watch Jeffrey Webb, along with CONMEBOL's president, Eugenio Figueiredo, formally announce the Copa America Centenario. After a typically effervescent presentation from the two officials, the media was given the chance to ask questions. Reporters from the mostly Spanish-language outlets in attendance wondered whether the tournament, jammed awkwardly into an already busy 2016 summer calendar, might be a dud. It was scheduled at nearly the exact same time as the ultra-popular European Championship, and just before the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, which also had a soccer tournament. Not only that, but this wholly manufactured event wasn't yet on FIFA's official schedule, which meant it was possible professional clubs wouldn't release big stars to play in the tournament. Figueiredo, a slight man in his early 80s who was dwarfed by the far younger and more robust-looking Webb, brushed off the concerns, cracked a few jokes, and took a moment to mention his very good friend Enrique Sanz. "We are praying for his recovery," he said. Webb, for his part, called the tournament, still more than 2 years away, a once-in-a-lifetime celebration. For the investigators working the soccer case, the day's events felt no less important. They'd only learned of the existence of the Centenario tournament less than 2 months earlier, but once they did, they realized it presented them a golden opportunity to catch people on tape. A joint CONCACAF-CONMEBOL press conference would draw any number of the targets of their probe. And unlike the London Olympics, where Blazer had made his recordings, this event was taking place within the friendly confines of the U.S. So, racing against the clock, the prosecutors and special agents worked to prepare their key cooperator, Jose Javila, for action. At their direction, he set up a series of meetings for the days around the press event. It wasn't hard to do. Because Javila hadn't left the country in almost a year, people throughout Latin America were eager to see him, particularly his new partners at Full Play and Torneos y Competencias. The Copa America enterprise was proving a resounding success. The Hinkieses had been able to sell the U.S. Spanish-language rights to the Centenario edition to broadcaster Univision for $71 million, more than double the value of the equivalent rights to the 2015 tournament, to be held in Chile. They figured they could get another $30 million from Fox for the English-language rights in the U.S. That meant all other rights sales, including broadcast in the rest of the world, plus sponsorships, would be pure profit. By their calculations, the joint venture, Datisa, was going to net between $80 million and $100 million in profit for each edition of the Copa America. But there were also reasons to be concerned. Avila's partners had learned that Jeffrey Webb still hadn't been paid his $10 million bribe, and wanted to understand what the holdup might be. They also knew that Javila had been trying to sell his company, and worried that a new owner of traffic wouldn't understand how their business really worked. "My fear," Mariano Hinkes said during a private meeting with his father and Javila at their beachfront hotel the night before the press conference, "is to have a partner who says, 'I can't pay payoffs. We don't make payoffs here.'" Javila refused entreaties to sell his share of Datisa back to his partners, saying he felt it would make traffic very weak. At the same time, he expressed discomfort with how aggressively the owners of Full Play handed out bribes, almost as if they enjoyed it. As they talked, Ugo Hincus appeared to almost relish explaining the complicated chain of shell companies he used to pay them out, bouncing wires from country to country to evade scrutiny. "This will not change," Mariano Hincus added. "There will always be payoffs. There will be payoffs forever." Although Havila had originally balked at wearing a wire, and never truly became comfortable recording his friends and associates, he had grown more adept at steering conversations toward where Randall or other agents on the case instructed him to take them. Immediately following the press conference the next morning, Havila, with Davidson in tow, approached Webb. The three posed for a photo alongside the imposing Copa America trophy, and then Havila, using Davidson as a translator, insistently attempted to get the CONCACAF president to talk about the $10 million bribe. When that went nowhere, Havila retired to the bar in the St. Regis lobby, where he met up with Burzaco and Ugo and Mariana Hincus. That meeting proved much more successful. Over snacks, Havila managed to get his Argentine partners to go over, repeatedly and in detail, the mechanics of the Copa America bribes, who received them, and what steps were taken to cover their tracks and make everything look legitimate. Satisfied he'd checked that box, Havila opened another line of questioning he'd been coached to ask, similar to the questions he'd posed to Davidson a few weeks earlier. "Think about this," Havila asked.
"Who could get hurt by this thing?"
"You mean with this contract, with this issue?" Burzaco replied with a laugh. "All of us." A potential buyer of traffic would examine the Datista deals, and the phony contracts they'd drummed up to justify bribe payments and see right through them. It would be far worse, the Torneos y Competencias executive said, if law enforcement got involved. Tomorrow, the money laundering agency from Buenos Aires could come to investigate, for example, or from Brazil, or the DEA, or anyone. And they will say, "What are all these payments?" Burzaco said. "All of us go to prison," he added. "All of us." Havila had made a host of recordings over the previous few days, sitting down with numerous people, including the president of Brazil's soccer federation, who was tied up in at least three different bribery schemes at once. Despite his awkward demeanor and reticent behavior, the cooperator had convinced people to admit to all sorts of complicity. But this last tape was the cherry on top. Reviewing the translated transcript of the meeting, the prosecutors in Brooklyn could hardly feel happier. It was exactly the kind of evidence they were hoping for. The net was getting tighter. As he did every morning, Berryman picked up his phone and scanned through his inbox before getting out of bed. Amid the junk mail, personal messages, and a string of Google alerts was an email from Evan Norris, which the IRS agent opened immediately. Norris kept written communications brief and to the point. Julio Grondona, he wrote, was dead. Wide awake now, Berryman looked at a few of the alerts. There were dozens of stories with the same news. Grondona, a FIFA vice president and chairman of its powerful finance committee, who had been president of the Argentine Soccer Association since 1979, and was one of the most powerful men in all of soccer, had died suddenly of a ruptured abdominal aorta at 82. It had happened in Buenos Aires the previous day, July 30th, 2014. Berryman sighed. He had put a ton of work into Grondona. Known as Don Julio, Grondona was the soccer world's closest equivalent to a movie mobster. Tall and sleek, with slicked back hair, drooping jowls, and cruel hangdog eyes, he spoke Spanish in a grunting mumble and steadfastly refused to learn any other language. He lambasted critics, ridiculed his rivals, and was known for disparaging comments about Jews, and in particular the English. Grondona had proudly admitted to voting for Russia and Qatar to host the World Cup, saying, "A vote for the United States is like giving it to England," and throughout his career, managed to escape numerous criminal probes within Argentina. Notorious for his gold pinky ring that said, "Todo pasa," or "All things pass," Grondona projected a humble image, holding court in a hardware store he owned in a hardscrabble neighborhood on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, or in the cramped back office of an out-of-the-way gas station. But in truth, decades of kickbacks and bribes had made him immensely wealthy, with properties scattered around the Argentine capital, including his residence in a luxury condominium in Buenos Aires' fashionable Puerto Madero district. At first, Berryman had been stymied in his attempts to root out the Argentine's bribes. Grondona was unusually careful, never using his own accounts to send or receive money, and seemed to assiduously avoid transactions within the U.S. But the determined IRS agent eventually discovered a way in. Alejandro Burzaco. Avila, in proffers, had described him as the same person as Grondona, and indeed it was hard to tell where one man's financial affairs ended and the other's began. Other than Grondona's children, in fact, Burzaco was the only person at Don Julio's bedside in the Buenos Aires hospital as he died. For the past several months, Berryman had focused his attentions on Burzaco and his company Torneos, using subpoenas to Fedwire and Chips as the initial can opener, and soon discovering numbered bank accounts in Switzerland that looked particularly suspect. Berryman wasn't sure yet, but it seemed as if Burzaco maintained special accounts that Grondona could access without having to actually put his name on them. He also seemed to do a lot of business in cash. Unwinding all this was a complicated project, and just as he was really getting into it, Berryman received word that he'd been offered a temporary duty assignment to work in the London embassy.
Berryman loved England, and for years had wanted to live there again.
He made no secret of the fact that he aspired to a permanent assignment there to finish his career. At the same time, Berryman didn't want to lose step on the soccer case. And so, after consulting with Norris, he decided he could go to London for a few months and simply work more hours in order to get everything done. He had also found some help. J.J. Kasich, the IRS agent in Orange County who had accompanied him on his first approach of Zorana Danis, was now on the case full-time. To free himself up to focus on Burzaco and Grondona, Berryman handed off tracing Full Play's money to the young agent. Every morning, Berryman would report to duty at the U.S. Embassy in London, helping coordinate tax and money laundering investigations between American and British law enforcement. Then, every night, he'd take advantage of the 8-hour time difference to California, getting on the phone with Kasich to read through spreadsheets line by line and suggest new subpoenas to file. The soccer case had been open for almost 4 years, and Berryman had been working on it full-time for 3 of them. They'd made tremendous progress, but they couldn't wait forever. The men who ruled soccer weren't getting any younger, and for that matter, neither was Steve Berryman. A few months earlier, he'd learned that the Brazilian soccer boss, Ricardo Teixeira, had returned to Brazil, where he was safe from extradition, and it was frustrating to think of all the hard work he'd put in on the former CBF president that might now be for nothing. Because of the 5-hour time difference, the IRS agent was forced to wait for hours before he could call Norris to discuss the news. Norris was more than a dozen years younger than Berryman, and sometimes jokingly referred to him as Dad. But now it was Berryman who looked to the prosecutor for fatherly guidance. Only Norris could soothe the feelings and frustrations that inevitably emerged on a case that meant so much to him. Losing Grondona and Teixeira was without a doubt frustrating. There was not a thing they could do. They had to stay focused. They would move when they were ready to move, the prosecutor insisted, and not a moment earlier. Oh well, Norris added. Let's move on. In the waning days of August, officers of the Royal Cayman Islands Police Service arrested a man named Canover Watson on suspicion of perpetrating a massive multi-million-dollar scheme to defraud the British territory's healthcare system. Watson had been on Berryman's radar, albeit distantly. He was treasurer of the Cayman Islands Football Association, one of 8 members of FIFA's Audit and Compliance Committee, and one of Jeffrey Webb's best friends and closest confidants. He even owned the mansion right next door to Webb's outside Atlanta. Whatever Watson was mixed up in back home had nothing to do with soccer, although the arrest did prompt FIFA to temporarily suspend him. It seemed to Berryman like yet another potential target might be falling out of his grasp. But the arrest did not come as a surprise. Some 3 months earlier, investigators with the Khemenian Police Force's Anti-Corruption Unit had reached out to both the FBI and the IRS through legal attachés stationed in the Caribbean. They were looking for information about Watson, and also about Webb. And because of that, their requests were soon filtered up to Jared Randall and Berryman. The RCIPS officers were asking questions about the properties both men had purchased in Georgia, and were hoping to get information from the banks involved in those transactions. The first instinct of Norris and the other prosecutors was to ignore the queries. They weren't going to risk the integrity of the whole investigation to help some minor corruption case in a tiny tourist resort with 60,000 residents. But Webb had become a central target, and it was hard not to wonder what these island cops might be poking around on. The arrest of Watson brought the issue, nearly forgotten, back to the fore. After considerable debate, the team decided to invite the RCIPS officers to New York to hear them out. As time passed, it had become ever more frustrating not to be able to ask other countries for help. Thanks to Berryman's money tracing, the team had been able to uncover a considerable amount about suspects. But there were vast stores of financial information tucked away abroad that they simply could not touch, most notably in Switzerland, with its strong protections for banking privacy. The Alpine country had a policy of notifying account holders whenever it provided foreign governments with financial records, which made such inquiries worthless in a clandestine investigation. But this situation was different. The Caymanians had come to the U.S. seeking information, not the other way around.
And meeting the foreign officer seemed like a good opportunity to learn a thing or two without having to reveal anything about their own case.
Coordinating a visit took some doing, and it was freezing cold when the Caymanians finally arrived in New York. After some whining about the weather, they explained Canover Watson's fraud. He'd been a rising star in the business community, the winner of the Young Caymanian Leadership Award, and in 2009 was named chairman of a government board overseeing its national healthcare system. A year later, the board awarded a multi-million dollar contract for a new healthcare payment system called CarePay. But the system didn't work well and was never fully implemented. And soon local authorities began poking around. They discovered that Watson and a partner secretly controlled the company being paid for the system, which was a clear conflict of interest and had never been disclosed. The partner was Watson's dear friend, Jeffrey Webb. A few months after the CarePay contract was awarded, the visitors continued. A series of suspicious transactions began to emerge. Webb bought his 9,800-square-foot house in Loganville, Georgia, on June 24, 2011, and, exactly 7 days later, Watson closed on the 7,600-square-foot house right next door. Around the same time, Fidelity Bank, where Webb still worked at the time, approved a $240,000 loan to J&D International, a company controlled by Jack Warner. The proceeds of that loan were wired to the account used to receive the CarePay funds, and from there to a Wells Fargo account in Georgia. A few months later, when the first CarePay money came through, the J&D International loan was paid off in full. Among other things, the foreign investigators were hoping to learn what had happened to the money in the Wells Fargo account. Norris and Berryman glanced at each other. Webb was clearly involved in a great deal more than crooked Gold Cup contracts. Considering his importance to the investigation, not to mention his connections to Warner, it was tantalizing to think about accessing Cayman Islands bank records. But it seemed too risky. Foreign police, they had learned, simply could not be trusted. The Americans didn't think they could be of any help. The prosecutors were sorry to say, but would be happy to buy their visitors dinner that evening and congratulate them on their good work. As a British territory, by law, the commissioner of the RCIPS must be from the United Kingdom. A large share of the 360-member police force is also British, drawn by the chance to live for a few years on a tropical paradise with some of the lowest crime rates in the entire Caribbean. It so happened that the investigators looking into Canover Watson were all expatriate Brits, and Berryman, an Anglophile to the core, hit it off with them. "I can guess what part of England you're from," Berryman said. Drawing on his childhood years in England, as well as his recent stint in the embassy in London, he listened to their accents, a grin spreading over his face. "You're from the north of London," he said, "and you're from Leeds, or Manchester. And you," he said, looking at the third cop, "support either Sunderland or Newcastle." A few hours of socializing had convinced Berryman that these men could be trusted. And though it took some persuasion, Norris and the other prosecutors eventually came around as well. They would help the Caymanian investigation after all. And in exchange, they would get invaluable information on Webb's financial doings that could help tie up the case they were building against him. America's soccer investigation, shaping up to be one of the largest international corruption probes in history, touching on dozens of countries spread over multiple continents, finally had a foreign partner. The irony of the fact that it happened to be one of the world's most notorious havens for tax evasion and money laundering was lost on no one. Chapter 25. Payback. "Rotten," screamed the huge headline on the New York Daily News on Sunday, November 2, 2014. "Secret Life of Soccer's Mr. Big." The front page carried a picture of Chuck Blazer standing next to Sepp Blatter, with the World Cup trophy superimposed over the image. Inside, a four-page spread broke the news that Blazer had been busted for failing to file taxes, became a cooperator for the FBI, and wore a wire at the London Olympics. The story, in classic New York tabloid style, pulled no punches, calling Blazer corrupt and corpulent, and recounting, breathlessly, his over-the-top lifestyle, personal peccadillos, and how he used a keychain containing a recording device to secretly tape conversations. A Falstaffian figure, Blazer, came to inhabit a world of private jets, famous friends, secret island getaways, offshore bank accounts, and so much fine food and drink that he eventually needed a fleet of mobility scooters to move from feast to feast. It was lurid, certainly, but the article's authors were also delivering a big scoop, revealing to the world for the first time that Blazer had been secretly helping a criminal investigation. The story noted that both the IRS and the FBI were involved, that the prosecutors were in Brooklyn, and that the investigation was looking at both fraud and money laundering. It was, at first blush, a rather troubling thing for Norris to read early on a Sunday morning. There was little mystery about the source. Blazer's former girlfriend, Mary Lynn Blanks, the former soap opera actress who had been living with him at the time, he flipped. She hadn't been present when Berryman and Randall first approached Blazer, nor had she attended any of the proffers or covert operations, but it was obvious that the former soccer official had told her what was going on. The two lived together, after all, and had been constant companions for years. Not long after the Olympics, however, they had split up acrimoniously. Blanks and her children moved out, leaving Blazer alone in his cavernous Trump Tower apartment. That the leak came from Blanks rather than someone inside the investigation tempered Norris's dismay. He was also relieved to see that the Daily News had made no mention of Blazer's guilty plea, any of the other cooperators, or that the investigation was being built around RICO, with defendants around the world. Blazer was burned as a cooperator, but frankly he was seriously ill, and of little use to the investigation anymore. If nothing else, the Daily News story reminded Norris that a case this large couldn't remain a secret forever. Wait too long, and the next leak could be truly damaging. The sheer amount of evidence the investigators had gathered by that point, including countless bank and business subpoenas, thousands of documents handed over by cooperators, and hundreds of hours of covert recordings in multiple languages, bordered on overwhelming. There was incriminating evidence, to a greater or lesser degree, on current or former soccer officials in nearly every country in the Western Hemisphere. After struggling with a case that initially seemed to be going nowhere, Norris's biggest problem now was not finding targets, but deciding when to cut off the investigation so they could move to indict. For some time, Norris and the growing team of prosecutors, now numbering four in all, had been thinking about when and where to finally bring the case into the light. The goal, as it was in mafia cases, was a big takedown, nabbing as many defendants as possible at once. Clearly, the best opportunity to act was going to be at some FIFA event. The organization's meetings and tournaments attracted not only top officials, but also the sports marketing executives that kept the whole enterprise running. The biggest FIFA event of all was, of course, the World Cup. But the 2014 edition, in Brazil, had wrapped up months earlier. And, given the country's constitutional prohibition on extraditing its citizens, a Copacabana takedown had never been under serious consideration. The coming year, 2015, held a number of regional tournaments and congresses, such as the Copa America in Chile and the CONCACAF Congress in the Bahamas. But it was no sure bet that any one of them would draw enough targets from other regions to be worth the effort. The most obvious choice was a big FIFA meeting in Zurich. In the third week of March, the FIFA Executive Committee would meet, and then, in late May, FIFA would hold its annual Congress, concluding with the presidential elections, in which Sepp Blatter was running for his fifth consecutive term. Each had its pros and cons. The elections were certainly higher profile, but some on the team worried that a takedown then would send the wrong message about what the U.S. was attempting to do. It could, they feared, be read as a frontal attack on soccer itself. The March meetings, on the other hand, were coming up quickly, and since they were not as high profile, ran the risk of drawing fewer suspects. Either way, it seemed clear that the big event was going to happen in Zurich, which meant coordinating with Switzerland's notoriously prickly law enforcement agencies. For the past decade, American prosecutors had been aggressively pursuing Swiss banks for abetting tax evasion, extracting $780 million from UBS in 2009 and $2.6 billion from Credit Suisse earlier in 2014, while focusing scores of other financial institutions to pay smaller fines and change their practices in order to avoid prosecution. Among other things, the nation's famous wall of silence had been partially breached. For the first time, Swiss banks had been obliged to provide account information on U.S. taxpayers to American law enforcement. The Justice Department's campaign had been roundly criticized by both the Swiss press and public, who viewed it as American imperialism, a kind of legal bullying that had buckled the knees of the country's most revered institutions and forced them to alter a deep-seated culture of secrecy that was a matter of national pride. Convincing the Swiss to conduct a huge and very public takedown of yet another of the country's most prominent organizations, FIFA, was going to require some delicate negotiations. Then, less than a week after the Daily News story was published, President Obama announced he was nominating Loretta Lynch to succeed Eric Holder as Attorney General. Lynch was the sitting U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, and as such, the soccer investigation was her case. Although she was numerous rungs up the ladder from Norris and the other prosecutors, she had been read in on the investigation since its early stages, and Norris had briefed her regularly on its progress. With a big office to oversee, she had plenty of other cases to worry about, and was known for trusting her prosecutors. For the most part, she just let Norris follow his instincts. As Attorney General, however, she could potentially be invaluable. Since she knew the case well, she could almost certainly be counted on to help smooth the way with top officials in the Swiss Attorney General's office and help get them on board. One of the arguments that would be critical was that this case wasn't, in fact, directed against soccer. At heart, it was an international money laundering case. The vehicle used for the bribery and fraud, generating all that dirty money, just so happened to be soccer. Rather than an attack on FIFA, the prosecutors would argue the case was, in fact, an attempt to rid the sport of the officials that had corrupted it. America, the sales pitch went, was looking out for the sport's best interests. Besides, the Swiss public had little love for FIFA. After years of negative press and endless accusations of corruption, it had become something of a national shame, an institution increasingly defined by its inability to police itself. Michael Garcia's ethics committee investigation was a perfect case in point. after more than a year and a half of interviews around the world, reviews of hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, and billings reported to approach $10 million, the former U.S. attorney had finally submitted his hotly anticipated report on the bidding process for the 2018 and 2022 World Cups to FIFA in early September. A month later, however, FIFA announced that it would not publish the 434-page document because it had to respect the personal rights of the people mentioned in the report, and instead would release only a summary. Then, when the 42-page synopsis was released on November 13, 2014, Garcia publicly condemned it, saying it contained numerous materially incomplete and erroneous representations of the facts. And when FIFA rejected an appeal by Garcia to release the full report, the American resigned in protest, producing yet another very public embarrassment for the organization. Without subpoena power, Garcia had been able to dig up little interesting new information. None of the people the feds were interested in, Ricardo Teixeira, Mohammed bin Hammam, Nicolás Laos, or Jack Warner, had agreed to sit for an interview with Garcia. The former prosecutor had been unable to even conduct the Russian portion of the investigation himself because he had been, ironically enough, added to a list of Americans barred from setting foot in the country as retribution for Magnitsky Act sanctions imposed by the U.S. In any event, the Russians almost completely avoided scrutiny by claiming that the computers they used for the bid had been leased and that their owner had destroyed all of them. As an investigative document, then, the Garcia report seemed disappointing at best. If anything, it stood out to the prosecutors in Brooklyn as symbolic of the cancerous impunity plaguing FIFA. If the report contained any important evidence of corruption, FIFA was clearly not going to do anything with it. As far as the small team of investigators working on the soccer case were concerned, there was nobody on the entire planet making any serious attempt to clean up the sport except for them. As winter approached and the days grew short, they began to talk more concretely about the moment they would finally make their big move, and the whole world would find out what they had been up to. It was going to be a great and important day. To celebrate the years of hard work, Norris promised to take Randall and Berryman to dinner at Peter Luger, a famous Brooklyn steakhouse where gruff old waiters throw down $80 platters of sizzling porterhouse. It seemed a fitting tribute, because Luger's happened to be Chuck Blazer's favorite restaurant. Blazer had been a terrific cooperator. There never could have been a case without him. When the Daily News article appeared, Randall tore off the front page and pinned it to the wall of his cubicle on the 23rd floor of 26 Federal Plaza, next to the receipt from the first lunch he'd had with Blazer more than 3 years earlier. As a joke, somebody had marked up the newspaper. "I don't carry keychains," a speech balloon out of Blazer's mouth read. "You do now," a second bubble said. "You work for me." Since the moment they flipped Avila 18 months earlier, the prosecutors had been intensely interested in figuring out exactly what he owned and how much it was worth. He was very rich, of course, but the government attorneys wanted him to catalog, in detail, all his assets and also provide a sense of what they could be sold for. So, even as he recounted the specifics of the bribes he paid, the intermediaries he used, and the phony contracts he concocted, the Brazilian was obliged many times to expose the inside of his figurative wallet. The prosecutors listened with rapt attention as Avila told them about traffic and its various divisions, about the North American Soccer League, about his TV stations, the multiple farms he owned in rural Sao Paulo State, his four houses in Brazil, and the condo on Fisher Island, his many cars, his various bank accounts, and even his collection of Brazilian art, which included one painting worth, by Avila's estimate, $200,000. They also kept tabs on his efforts to sell traffic. Despite some interest from European buyers, the company still lingered frustratingly on the market. Meanwhile, Avila had, in December 2013, unloaded his newspapers, including Diario de São Paulo, for just 30 million reals, or about $13 million, a huge loss on what had turned out to be a terrible investment. Most recently, Avila had convinced Chinese investors to buy the soccer training grounds he'd built in Porto Feliz, along with Desportivo Brasil, the local team he owned, for a total of 38 million reals, or roughly $17 million. Avila's gross dishonesty over the first 9 months of cooperation was, to a large degree, an attempt to protect the value of the companies he had built from nothing. But his infuriating behavior betrayed a grave misreading of the rules underlying cooperating with a federal investigation, of human nature, and most importantly, of the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. When RICO was passed into law in October 1970, it marked the first time in 180 years that the federal government had been empowered to seize assets from individuals as a direct consequence of their crimes. Until then, the government could seize assets used to commit crimes, such as the boat of a drug runner used to smuggle cocaine, but it could not remove property from criminals simply because they committed a crime. RICO codified efforts to bind criminals to the enterprises they corrupted, and the ill-gotten gains of their corruptions. Violators faced fines and up to 20 years in prison. But perhaps the most innovative and powerful punitive tool was asset forfeiture. Those convicted under RICO could be obliged to forfeit any assets tied directly or indirectly to the criminal enterprise they were involved in. Forfeiture serves as both penalty and deterrent, designed to send a powerful message to other would-be criminals. The government can take every penny. On December 12, 2014, Jose Avila finally was permitted to sign his cooperation agreement with the prosecutors from the Eastern District of New York. It said the Brazilian would agree to plead guilty to RICO conspiracy, wire fraud conspiracy, money laundering conspiracy, and obstruction of justice, a charge that had been expanded to include not just the interactions with Blazer that provoked his arrest, but his months of lying to prosecutors while cooperating. Avila's prolonged deception had set the investigation back, but more important, it had put it at terrible risk. Altogether, his crimes carried a maximum sentence of 80 years, and although prosecutors could make recommendations, the judge would have final word on how much prison time would be dispensed. But it is the prosecutors in a RICO case who make the final determination of how much money will be criminally forfeited. Under terms of his cooperation agreement, negotiated and countersigned by Norris, Avila was consenting to forfeit to the United States of America a total of $151,713,807.43. It was a shocking sum, more than 75 times larger than Chuck Blazer's forfeiture, and triple the gross domestic product of Montserrat, one of the CFU members whose World Cup qualifier rights Avila had acquired thanks to a $3 million bribe to Jeffrey Webb. To pay the forfeiture, Avila would have little choice but to liquidate much of what he owned at whatever price he could get, including, and especially, traffic. The first installment of $25 million was due that very same day, when Avila, a humbled man of 71, faced Judge Raymond Deary shortly after 10:15 in the morning in his courtroom in Cadman Plaza. Avila had come to the U.S. in May 2013 for just a week and had never left. For the past 19 months, he'd been trapped in a country that was not his own. Separated from his friends and family, and subject to the whims of a handful of government lawyers who didn't speak his language and knew next to nothing about the sport to which he had dedicated his life, Avila had watched his companies come under assault from aggressive competitors and his business empire shrink. And when he was cornered, he'd been forced to break confidences and betray people he'd known and loved for decades. With an indictment still far on the horizon, and a trial where he might be called upon to testify long after that, not to mention a likely prison term, it could be years before Avila was allowed to go home. Quite apart from his concocted cover stories of plausible ailments, Avila had in fact been diagnosed with cancer in his mouth while cooperating, and had gone through a brief round of chemotherapy and radiation. A pre-existing lung condition, meanwhile, had been exacerbated by all the stress. It had been depressing, frightening, and profoundly isolating. Because the investigation was still secret, Judge Deary's courtroom had been cleared, and Havila was forced to confess to his crimes alone, without even his faithful wife, Eliani, by his side.